Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're sure feeling grateful here in the Main Street studio. To all of you who took part in Giving Tuesday, we are thankful for your support, and we look forward to serving all of our listeners in the year ahead. Coming up in just a bit, Dr. Tom Ezern has another of his great Plains Folk essay. A Generous and Steadfast Friend is what this one is titled. And also we'll check in with the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Lots happening there in December. And we begin Main Street today, joined with reporter Jacob Orledge of the North Dakota Monitor. He's the reporter whose recent coverage has unpacked a landmark ruling in a long-running legal challenge to North Dakota's carbon capture law. Today, we'll discuss how a law that forces some landowners to allow underground CO2 storage, even if they didn't consent, was struck down by a district court judge. And we'll talk about what led up to that decision and what it might mean for property rights and energy projects in the state. Jacob, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks for having me on, Craig.
First, let's define, Jacob, if we could, what pore space is, P-O-R-E space, and its relevancy to what we're going to talk about today.
Absolutely. So pore space are the cavities and the very tiny empty space that is found underground in rock formations. So in the context of today's discussion, pore space is a mile, 2 miles underground in rock formations where companies and the state want to inject resources like CO2, carbon dioxide, in order to store it in that pore space for potentially a very long time.
So some landowners, many landowners said, hey, we're okay with that. Some landowners said, you know, no, we're not. And kind of here we are at this loggerhead with a court decision that now has been reversed by a district court judge. Tell us about the timeline, if you would, Jacob, of the case that we're talking about today.
Sure. So this is actually the second lawsuit that the Northwest Landowners Association, which is a group of landowners in the state, an advocacy group, the second lawsuit that group has brought against the state for a law regulating pore space that the legislature has passed. The Supreme Court initially overturned a law in 2022. This is the North Dakota Supreme Court. About a year later, the Northwest Landowners Association brought a second lawsuit challenging a separate but related law also on pore space. And that is the lawsuit we are here to talk about today. That lawsuit has had a winding road. It was initially filed in 2023. Let's see, I believe it would have been in 2024. The district court initially dismissed the lawsuit, because the district court found that the statute of limitations had ran out. One of the laws at issue was passed in 2009. That was appealed to the Supreme Court, and the North Dakota Supreme Court earlier this year said, no, the statute of limitations has not run out on this. And they sent it back to district court to rule on the merits of the case. And that is the decision that came out this week. The district court ruled on the merits and decided that the law in question was unconstitutional.
That law had to do with this term called amalgamation, if I'm saying that correctly. What does it mean in this context? And I think I may have alluded to it just a moment ago.
Yes. So amalgamation in this context is the process by which the North Dakota Industrial Commission, the body which regulates oil and gas and other energy industries in the state, amalgamation is the process by which the Industrial Commission can essentially pool the pore space underground. So let's back up a step, because pore space is sort of like crude oil underground. Crude oil, if you take a square mile of crude oil underground and you drill a well and you extract that resource, that oil is not going to come from just one property. It's going to come from all of the property owners in that square mile. As an example, I'm sure anybody in the oil and gas industry will be able to tell you it's a little more complicated than that. But the point is, 25% or the owners of 25% of that square mile cannot stand up, object, say, no, we don't want our oil taken out. Well, the same concept applies to pore space. When you inject a substance into underground pore space, it is going to spread across boundary lines, regardless of who owns the surface property. So amalgamation is the process by which the Industrial Commission can decide, hey, that project area, for example, let's use that analogy, that square mile, even if 10% of the landowners in that square mile don't want to sign up with the project, amalgamation is forcing them to participate in the project.
So then, why did the judge believe this week that that's not a constitutional way to proceed?
So the judge essentially found two things. One, that the amalgamation is a unconstitutional taking, that it was a government authorized invasion of private property. And then the judge followed up and said, it is a government authorized invasion of private property, a taking of private property rights, and the landowners did not receive just compensation. And just compensation is a term that's important because it's found in the North Dakota state constitution. Whenever the government seizes private property for a public use, the landowner has a right to receive quote unquote just compensation as determined by a jury.
I have some experience with this in a little bit of a different way. My mother-in-law used to live in Eaton, Colorado. And oil companies came in and started drilling horizontally. In other words, the wellhead was well east of town, but it came underneath the town of Eaton, including my mother-in-law's property. She gets a knock on the door and says, okay, we're going to take the oil that's way down there, but you're going to get a royalty check from us. And so that $60 a year royalty check started rolling in. But it's the same sort of argument here that there must be some just compensation. Jacob, is that similar or is this something very different? Or somewhere in the middle, maybe?
It's both similar and different. And the reason I say that is it is similar in principle to the idea that when you drill an oil well, you need to essentially pool those underground interests. But it is different because the judge addressed this in his ruling. He essentially said that while pooling is fine for oil and gas because you're maximizing the ability to extract a resource, in this case, that doctrine of law does not apply because amalgamation is attempting to maximize the permanent storage of a resource.
You're putting something back in the land. You're not selling anything. You're putting something back into the land.
Exactly. And there is still a lot to come in this case because the district court will not have the final, will likely not have the final say. There's no official word on who, if anyone, will appeal the case to the North Dakota Supreme Court. But most observers seem to assume that the state will appeal this. The Supreme Court will give a ruling and we will have additional clarity on this moving forward. But it is a complex body of law, and I would not want to weigh in on that from a legal perspective. Well, just to be clear, this lawsuit was challenging the law itself. It was not challenging any specific project. Amalgamation has been used for multiple carbon dioxide storage projects here in North Dakota. In some of those cases, where companies were not able to obtain the consent of 100% of the landowners in a given area, there have been negotiating differences, to my understanding. Landowners have asked for certain things from the companies to be included in a lease, and companies were either were essentially unwilling to grant those terms. And of course, the details of those negotiations are different case by case. And I don't think we have time to get into them here. But in general, landowners want to be able to negotiate those contracts with the companies. Their primary objection to the law, or maybe I shouldn't say primary, but one of their biggest objections to the amalgamation law is that the Industrial Commission is requiring them to participate in a project and be governed by a lease that they have not signed.
Enjoying my conversation with Jacob Orlidge. He's a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor, and we're talking about his recent coverage about a landmark ruling in a long-running legal challenge to North Dakota's carbon storage law. Jacob, as we move forward, is it too early to know whether this case sets precedent for other carbon storage or pipeline related projects in North Dakota or even beyond?
Well, I will say that there will be a precedent set if and when the case is appealed to the North Dakota Supreme Court. As of right now, everybody involved, or almost everybody involved, is still trying to evaluate the ruling and decide what the implications are. I do know that the attorney for the Landowners Association argues that because the law was found to be unconstitutional, any permits granted under that law are essentially void. So companies have to stop injecting carbon dioxide until and unless the Supreme Court overturns it. But nobody else has been willing to, nobody else has been able to confirm that just yet. I believe everybody is still digesting the ruling and just trying to figure out where we go from here as a state. Once it is appealed to the North Dakota Supreme Court, then we will have a precedent, Craig.
Do we know what reactions then have been? You've visited, or you've talked about the attorney from the Landowners Association, from the energy companies, from the regulators, based on your reporting. How are they viewing this ruling?
I would say uncertainty. It is the primary reaction, especially from non-landowners, from the energy companies, from stakeholders in the industry, from the state. A lot of stakeholders are declining to comment on specifics of the ruling because, as I mentioned, they're still digesting it. They're still reviewing it and considering what the implications might be.
You reported on energy law expert Owen Anderson's suggestion that the decision could open the door to challenges of other pore space uses like saltwater disposal. How worried are oil and gas operators about that possibility?
We haven't heard too much about that possibility just yet. I am not an expert on saltwater disposal and other uses of pore space. I can tell you that Owen Anderson, who is an energy law professor at the University of Texas, who began his career here in North Dakota working for the Industrial Commission as an energy attorney, his concern is that the ruling opens the door to additional legal challenges to those other uses of pore space for waste, for saltwater disposal, for natural gas storage, and that could, in theory, pose an issue because some of those are necessary for the continued operation of the oil and gas industry. But I could not, I would not be able to delve too deeply into that, Craig. I am not an expert on those other uses.
The other thing I'm wondering is how industry has felt that, hey, you know what? A small minority of pore space owners should not be able to block projects that have a majority support. Landowners who supported this use, do we know what they're thinking today?
That is an argument that's been brought up by several stakeholders. If you check out our coverage on the North Dakota Monitor, we cite several people as making that argument. Senator Dale Patton from Watford City and Ron Ness from the North Dakota Petroleum Council both pointed out that this decision opens up the possibility that somebody, that one landowner in a project area can object and halt the forward progress of a project. Or one person who opposes the project can buy 1 acre in a project area and essentially scrap the entire thing, or at least that is their fear and their concern of what the implications of this ruling might be. As far as landowners themselves who support the project, There are a number of landowners who sign on to these carbon dioxide storage projects. Summit Carbon Solutions, for example, has signed on and obtained the consent of around 92% of the landowners in the project area. We do not have any, we have not heard any opinions or input from those landowners, but obviously they do have a large majority of those landowners who have been willing and willing to sign the contract Summit has proposed.
Eminent domain has been injected into this discussion as well. The power of the government to take private property for public use. Is the legislature going to weigh in more about this, do you think?
Nobody knows. So landowners' argument is that there's already a way forward for these companies, that they should attempt to partner with landowners, negotiate contracts, and attempt to get 100% voluntary participation with these CO2 storage projects. And then if a company cannot obtain 100% participation, landowners' argument is that if it's being used for a public use, like a public utility who's doing this, they can go through the eminent domain process. And while landowners may not enjoy it, they do understand that process. There are certain protections enshrined in that process. And landowners' attorneys, in this case, say that would be the appropriate way forward.
Let's zoom out a little bit, Jacob. Do you see this as a North Dakota-specific fight? Or do you feel that this is a test case and that other states and other carbon pipeline projects around the country are watching this closely?
So I'm not sure I can speak to what other states are watching or what impact this might have on other states. I have not done a ton of reporting on what other states have been doing in this space. I can say that the decision of a North Dakota District Court or even a decision of the North Dakota Supreme Court will not have any direct impact on what can or cannot happen in other states. Whether other courts will take their lead from North Dakota, I can't say. I will say that from the people that I've spoken to, North Dakota is, from the people that I've spoken to, no other state seems to have taken the approach that the North Dakota District Court has as of now.
What should our listeners look forward to relative to this case? You've talked perhaps about, hey, the Supreme Court is going to hear this one way or the other. Do we have a sense yet of the timeline for that, or is it just too early to tell?
There is no official timeline yet. From the people involved and the observers who have been watching this case, who expect the case to be appealed by the state, I've heard predictions suggesting that this case will play out in front of the Supreme Court during the calendar year of 2026. If the appeal is, if the case is appealed in the near future, I had one attorney suggest that briefings, that the process could begin rolling in the spring and summer, and that there could be a ruling later in the year. So that is one possible timeline. But of course, we're not going to have any official timeline until at the very least an appeal is actually filed. One other thing I do want to mention, Craig, is that every landowner group, every landowner attorney that I've spoken to on the subject of CO2 projects, I have not encountered one who objects to the principle of the projects. And I do want to just make this clear because this is something they like to emphasize. They're not objecting to carbon dioxide storage. They want to negotiate contracts for that storage that they find acceptable. And one of their main objections has been when companies decline to do so. And as a result, these landowners are being forced to abide by terms imposed by the North Dakota Industrial Commission. Landowners are arguing just they want companies to negotiate in good faith, reach contracts, and find a mutually acceptable solution.
This is Jacob Orlich. He's a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor. You can read about his extensive reporting about this case and many other issues as well in the North Dakota Monitor. And we'll keep watching for developments. Of course, when the appeal is filed. If it is filed, Jacob, I'm sure we'll have you back on to further dissect this for our listeners. Thank you, Jacob, so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thanks for having me on, Craig.
Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
The Northern Lights were making national news a few weeks ago. Reports of the displays came streaming in from as far south as Florida. Seeing them always seems to elicit a sense of wonder and awe, and there may well be more shows to come this winter. Northern Lights are associated with solar storms and the resultant strong solar winds. When those strong solar winds collide with gases and ions in the atmosphere near the North Pole, it causes them to glow. The different colors are due to differences in the amount of energy given off by different atoms or molecules. In the northern hemisphere, the display is called aurora borealis, or more commonly, northern lights. The phenomenon also occurs near the South Pole, where it's known as aurora australis, or southern lights. Remember that the U.S.-Canada border is the 49th parallel. Between about 55 degrees and 80 degrees north latitude, the northern lights may be observed somewhere about every other night. As one might expect, the frequency drops southward. But if the sky is clear, North Dakotans often have several opportunities per year to observe the northern lights. As one might expect, the northern lights were woven into the cultural mythology of earlier civilizations. The Inuit believed they were celestial spirits playing a game of football with a walrus skull. Some other Native American tribes perceived them as gods dancing in the sky, or perhaps the harbingers of good weather. Northern lights likely played several roles in Norse mythology. One explanation was that they were flickers of the Valkyrie's armor as they rode across the sky. Another myth, likely inspired by the northern lights, was that of Bifrost, a burning, trembling bridge or arch that allowed the gods to travel from the heavens to earth. Some even thought they were reflections of large swarms of herring. The first explanation given to me when I first saw them was that it was just the right set of conditions to see the sunlight reflecting off the polar ice cap. So be on the watch for the future auroral shows. Local TV and radio meteorologists will usually announce them. I've put links to more information on the northern lights, including one by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that contains information and predictions on when and where the northern lights may be observed, along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Bird Note. Lily Arison Renee de Roland is the Madagascar Program Director for the Peregrine Fund. He works with some of the rarest birds in the world, like the Madagascar fish eagle.
Madagascar fish eagle is a critically endangered species. And at the beginning of the 90s, when the Peregrine Fund began to work in Madagascar, the population number was very low.
These large raptors only eat fish, which means they rely on the same diminishing wetlands and natural resources as some fishing communities. For example,
the fishermen used a wood canoe, and one wood canoe can be used only for 2 years. So every 2 years, they must cut a big tree to have a new canoe. And Madagascar fish eagle uses big trees for nesting.
So the Peregrine Fund invested in durable fiberglass canoes that last closer to 16 years. So each canoe saves roughly 8 nesting trees. Lily says this is just one way that community-centered conservation can support Madagascar's people and wildlife.
Our objective is to protect the Madagascar fish eagle and also to protect the wetland for the future generations.
Learn more at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Still to come on Main Street, Dr. Tom Ezern wrestles with a question. Is higher education merely transactional or fundamentally relational? Plus, we'll check in with North Dakota Gateway to Science. Lots happening in that great place in Bismarck in December. Stay with us. Street continues on this Thursday as we visit with our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave and I review the news. Dave, welcome back to Main Street. It's been a week or two since we've had a chance to chat.
You bet. Good to be back, Greg.
Dave, the Emergency Commission has okayed funds for private company inspections of state buildings in certain cities. Boy, that sounds like an innocuous headline, but there's a lot more going on here.
Oh, you need to unpack this one. It caught me off guard because I thought it was just kind of a simple thing, saw it on the agenda, and it turned into more. Now, what has happened is that the state and the state fire marshal would go to local fire departments where they've got state buildings in their, in your town, especially Bismarck, Fargo, Grand Forks, Minot, and you say, okay, let's do this. We require an inspection every 3 years. But when the state lab went up, and it's going up, it's not completely done, there was an issue there that Bismarck did not want to do the inspections anymore, and that got them looking at the idea of maybe hiring private firms to come in, because apparently there's been some pushback from some in Fargo and maybe some in Grand Forks too, and the reason is that the state doesn't pay for any of the fees for any of the zoning or anything like that. They don't pay the city anything. So, and the fire departments do the inspections free of charge, basically. And they're saying, no, with property tax caps, you got to pay something.
So we're starting to push a little bit here, Dave, it sounds to me like.
It is. I think that, you know, there's some objection to caps by the local governments. They want a little bit more flexibility. Or they may want to see if there could be a law change where if a state's going to build a building somewhere, you have to go and pay the fees to get it built.
All right, let's move along, Dave. Our colleague Danielle Webster reported that there's a lower turnout for flu and COVID-19 vaccines, and it's not just lower, it's significantly lower.
Significantly
here in North
lower,
Dakota.
Yeah. Well, part of that might be the guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and the new health secretary on that. But, you know, 30% of women are still choosing to vaccinate for RSV, and that's pretty good. And their parents have been choosing the immunizations at about 60% rate, which is not too bad. But pediatric rates for influenza and COVID-19 are down, and that's kind of a sad story. And then there's some other things that might be out there on the horizon that might be coming. Saw some information about something, some kind of novel virus that might be on its way too. So there's some real concern about making sure people get vaccines.
And let's hope we can get through the winter here without too much tragedy relative to sickness. Dave, Xcel Energy has now reached a settlement with the Public Service Commission over an electric rate case. Mm-hmm. What's the latest?
The latest is that they'd filed for a 19% increase, but when they negotiated with PSC advocacy staff, and with the intervener, which is Walmart, they got it down to an 11% increase. And they're doing some things. They're not going to do as many upgrades to some things as they were going to do, but they will still be, you know, using some of the money to upgrade power lines, upgrade for infrastructure. And one thing that's kind of interesting, Craig, Xcel is maybe talking about a natural gas peaking plant to be located in eastern North Dakota to help out when, you know, the wind isn't blowing or anything like that. If you need some more power, they'll use it for peak times.
Dave, I just have to ask, did AI enter into any of this discussion, or is Xcel claiming that these rate increases don't have to do with AI? And they also say it's worth noting, say that they haven't had a rate increase over a four-year period. Is that right? And if you reduce that down, it's just 2.5% to 3% per year.
That is correct. And they're saying AI does not do it. And they say, no, data centers are not driving this. The driving is, you know, replacing some of the old infrastructure. And, you know, it costs a little bit more to generate electricity now that they have retired coal-fired power plants in Minnesota.
Dave, the State Industrial Commission has okayed two loan programs that are designed to help farmers dealing with some things that are beyond their control. What's up with that?
Well, commodity prices are down and input costs are up. And farmers are saying they're really going to possibly struggle to make it in planting next year. And the bank decided to step in and propose this to the Industrial Commission, which approved it, to do these loans that are, again, are kind of bridge loans to help farmers stay in business, to help farmers get the inputs they need and make sure that they can at least plant and harvest next year.
Dave, I'm guessing you knew Carol Olson. She guided Republican resurgence in North Dakota and led Human Services. Unfortunately, last Sunday, she passed away in Colorado. What's your recollection of her?
Carol Olson was running political campaigns. She ran Governor Schaefer's campaign, but she also worked for the Department of Human Services. It was not Health and Human Services at the time. And everybody, and my recollection too, is she was very good at the Department of Human Services. She cared about people, cared about human service programs, and really was a good voice when she brought that case to the legislature. She was really something else. I mean, she was tough, but she really did have a good heart. I found her easy to talk to. I could talk to her about anything, and she would go on the record with me all the time, which was good. And I did watch how, you know, some of the things that Human Services was doing really stepped up their game with Carol at the helm.
Dave, you have some new reporting on a special session.
Well, yeah, this will not happen. They won't make the exact decision now, but we have a committee that was set up to look at this, what they're going to do in terms of this rural health initiative that's part of the Big Beautiful Bill. And they're coming to some closure on that, perhaps as early as today. But when the session's going to happen, well, we'll probably kick down to the Legislative Management Committee. And the thought among legislators I've talked to is possibly March for a special session. And it may not be a long one, but it will be a special session.
Dave Thompson, he and I review the news on Thursdays. Dave, have a great rest of your week, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you, Craig. You too.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today on Plains Folk, Dr. Tom Ezern reflects on a question that weighs heavily on many in higher education. Is college simply about credentials and contracts, or is it truly about relationships? That question lingered with him after a recent interview on campus, and it followed him straight into the archives at NDSU. There he uncovered the letters of Dr. Merton Field, one of the very first graduates of the North Dakota Agricultural College back in 1895. What Ezern found in those papers, stories of mentorship, perseverance, and the bonds that shaped a life, offered him an unexpected answer.
In a meeting on campus a few days ago, along with many of the best and brightest at NDSU, interviewing a candidate for a high position in the university, I asked the question often on my mind these days as a, you know, senior dude at our land-grant university, the People's College, as we used to say, is higher education, college learning, I asked, fundamentally transactional, a matter of contracts and credentials, or is it relational, a matter of mentorships and relationships? I'll tell you later how that came out. In the meantime, I went from that meeting directly to the archives to dive into a manuscript collection of the Institute for Regional Studies, which in the 1950s, under the guidance of Professor Leonard Sackett, acquired amazing research collections, great and small. One of the small ones comprises the papers of Dr. Merton Field. The minutes of the directors of North Dakota Agricultural College record that on the 25th of June, 1895, they approved baccalaureate degrees for five young men, the first graduating class of North Dakota Agricultural College. One of them was the son of homesteaders on Apple Creek in Burley County, a thoughtful lad named Merton Field. He stayed on to attain a master's in biology with a rather obscure thesis, but also authored a bulletin on the medicinal plants of North Dakota. Thence, it was on to the medical school at Minnesota. Field practiced in several Minnesota towns, did postdoctoral work at several institutions, including Harvard. He was an eye, ear, nose, and throat guy who practiced until 1951, died in 1959. Dr. Field had a sense of history and wrote a 131-page memoir about his youth on Apple Creek, which I'll get to another time. But given that question still on my mind, I was transfixed by reading his letters, in particular his experiences as a farm boy at the Ag College. As he neared completion of his medical studies at Minnesota, Field wrote back to Professor Henry Bolle at NDAC, who was a celebrity scientist by this time, to thank him for teaching and encouraging him for being, he attested, steadfast, though others were overcritical. There have been times, Field confessed, when I did not appreciate you as I do now, but through all I feel that you have been a generous and steadfast friend. I confess, when I read Field's letters to Bolle, I blinked away a tear or two, and then went on to read some of his late-in-life correspondence with another graduate among the first five, Robert Reed. There are intimate details dealing with matters such as the death of Field's wife, on which I here draw a curtain of privacy. But there also are stories about memorable relationships established at college, recalling, he says, the years when we were classmates in that small Dakota school. Wonderful days for me, as without funds I had to make my way by doing any sort of work that came my way. Memory tells me of our great Professor Ladd, Field continues. And then he tells the story of when he ran out of money and decided to quit school. But Edwin Ladd instead encouraged him to enter an essay contest with a $25 prize. He won with an essay about his father's success as a pioneer farmer. Only later did he learn that Ladd was a judge of the essay competition. And so you and I, Field closes a letter to his old friend, are probably the only left of our class. Possibly because when I asked that question in the interview room, the candidate answered it pretty well, on the one hand this and on the other hand that. But in the presence of Dr. Field, I realized her answer was itself transactional. So ask me now. I'm ready for the question.
You've been listening to Plainsfolk, where Dr. Tom Ezrin reminds us that the heart of education and of prairie history is found not just in institutions and achievements, but in the relationships that sustain us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and Northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today we're checking in again with North Dakota's Gateway to Science. It's the State Hands-On Science Center. It's beautiful. It's located in Bismarck. Joining us is Emily Montgomery, STEM educator at Gateway to Science. Emily, welcome back to Main Street.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Craig.
Got lots to talk about today. You had a recent event, Einstein on Wine, annual fundraiser. How did that go?
It was so much fun, Craig. So we have our annual fundraising event that's held every November, and it was on November 21st, and the night was filled with so much fun. We had a lot of games. We had really great food and drinks. There was a lot of fun STEM challenges for everyone, and it was a really great experience for them because if they did all of the things in the gallery and did the challenges downstairs, it would help them compete in an even bigger challenge during the meal beforehand and doing that. So we had that with a lot of great brain teasers and different things. And just the overall celebration of our mission was really amazing to see. And just knowing that who we are and what we do, like, we're just so incredibly grateful for the support of our community, because that is why we're here. So it was very successful event for
give
sure.
Give me a feeling and give our listeners a feeling of how important this Einstein for Wine event is to your yearly mission.
Yeah. So all of these people that they help us fundraise our mission, and they, all of these people consist of different organizations, different people just individually. All of them are donating through the silent auction, the live auction, and just varieties of ways, even throughout the entire year, not just Einstein on Wine. They do such a wonderful job of just contributing to who we are. They see our mission and they walk alongside us within that. And that's something that is just so beautiful to see as a nonprofit, that they may not even be doing STEM the way we do STEM, but they are providing and they're supporting us and their company. So seeing that value and that they're helping and walking alongside us is so beautiful.
Can you give me an example of one of the brain teasers to see if I would have been able to solve it or not?
Oh, I'm sure you could have, Craig. So one of the ones that we did was, if they filled out their bingo cards downstairs, if they visited all the different tables downstairs, whether it was the pick a duck challenge from our water table, everything was incorporated into the gallery. So you had a challenge that was embedded into the gallery, and then they would go upstairs with their filled out bingo card, and then they could choose from using either a straw, a packing peanut, or a pipe cleaner. And they had no idea what the challenge was for upstairs. And they had to build a certain type of structure with their table. So it was a whole joint event, and they had to make sure they had enough supplies. And realizing that packing peanuts, which I didn't know if you know this, but when you lick them, they can stick together. Ah. So they're trying to make the tallest structure. Whichever table had that got to eat first. So it was quite the event, and it was very fun. So
what did we build with our packing peanuts?
They just built the tallest tower. That was one of the supplies that could contribute to it. So they had to use different materials like straws, the pipe cleaners, and other things to make the tallest tower at their table. So they're using those extra.
I'm not going to tell my grandkids that licking the packing popcorn is going to be a good way to have fun.
Hey, they can make their own tallest structure out of
that. That's right. That sounds like a fun event. Speaking of events. We've got a lot of things coming up in December.
So
give us the list.
Things. Yes, absolutely. So right now coming up is December 6th. We have Gateway After Dark, and that is from 6:30 to 9. And that will be with Damon and Jeff. And they will be doing astrophotography from 7 to 7:45. And that will be just a really fun event to just learn more about what that even means, how that looks like in the world of astrophotography. It's a really big name, but it's something that everyone can use, and even how to take pictures. We had the Northern Lights just happen recently, and everyone knows that if we take the picture, those Northern Lights looked so much more clearer on our phones than what we saw.
I'm sad about that, by the way. I take the picture, right? And it's beautiful, and I barely see it.
And our naked eye just can't see it. So they're going to be providing some insight. So next time you can get the settings just right, even on any type of phone, to get those pictures done. So
who's this aimed at, age group wise?
This will be at 21 and above. This will be our adult event, Gateway After Dark, and that can be found on our website as well with more information. We also have December 8th is our other Gateway After Dark from 1 to 2:30. That will be in the afternoon, and it's our digital literacy event. And that's sponsored by AARP. So that is just giving all the different details on AI, what in the world that means, how to have password protection. So all of those different things to learn about and understand, because digital literacy is always constantly growing and moving and shaking. So it's a good thing to learn about. We also have December 10th and 13th. Now we're going more towards our littles. So we have preschool discovery coming up those 2 days, and that will be our Happy Healthy Me event. And that is where it's from 9 to 9:50. And that is where you come and learn. We're partnering with Essentia Health, all about the health of you and just the germs. We know it's cold and flu season. So we have Essentia Health that will be partnering with us this month, talking about germs, what it means when germs spread, and bringing that to a preschool level so that they're able to understand why it's important to make sure that we stay happy and healthy. We also have on December 31st, our New Year's Eve celebration from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. That one we're doing on New Year's Eve Day. So if you're someone who doesn't want to stay up till midnight, or you have a family of littles that can't stay up till midnight, this is a great event to just come right at noon on New Year's Eve day. We'll be doing a countdown, so come a little bit beforehand. We'll have a bunch of different activities. We'll have booths with different STEM challenges. You can come and then you can count us down, and we'll have a big balloon drop in our lobby, and it will be very fun.
It's almost New Year's. We have to think about that already, Emily.
Right? I know.
For anyone who's hoping to attend some or all of these December programs, tell us again where you're located and what your holiday hours or special closures, if you have any, are.
Yes, so you can find all of our information on our North Dakota's Gateway to Science website that will have all of our hours listed of when we're closing, when we're open, and when we have all our amazing events. So you can check it out on the website or our social media on Instagram and Facebook as well.
My guest has been Emily Montgomery. Folks from the North Dakota Gateway to Science visit with us generally on Thursdays. We're happy to have you, Emily, getting ready to usher out the great 2025. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 4th. On the morning of July 30th, 1916, New York City was jarred awake by a huge explosion. Four people were killed. Thousands of windows were blown out, and the Statue of Liberty was hit with debris. A storage depot on Black Tom Island, which held 2 million tons of supplies destined for the Allies in Europe, had gone up in flames. The United States was technically still neutral, but war had come to her shores. The explosion was part of a sabotage campaign unleashed by the German government as soon as the war broke out in Europe. German sabotage was widespread. Horses being shipped to Europe were infected with anthrax. Explosions destroyed U.S. munitions factories. Fires broke out on ships headed to Europe with supplies. In 1916, it was estimated that 8% of the American population consisted of people of German descent. They brought their culture with them, and it was strong across the country. Some cities were almost entirely German and bore German names. Many cities had a little Germany, with German food, restaurants, and shops. The German ambassador promised that German immigrants would rise up against the United States if the nation entered the war. In November of 1916, North and South Dakotans were concerned about an epidemic of fires that destroyed elevators and warehouses in both states. Two phosphorus plants were destroyed. Germans came under suspicion for setting unexplained fires and other acts of vandalism. Three separate fires, assumed to be caused by German saboteurs, almost leveled the town of Lemon, South Dakota. Three elevators and 20 businesses went up in flames. Vigilantes put the town under martial law. Strangers were automatically searched and watched carefully. On this date in 1917, it was reported that two Germans with 100 sticks of dynamite were somewhere out in the Badlands near Medora. The manager of the Consolidated Coal Company in Medora reported that two Germans had applied for work, but never reported for duty. When they disappeared in the night, the dynamite disappeared with them. The culprits were seen carrying suitcases. Authorities believe they loaded the boxes of dynamite on a westbound train while it was switching in the yards. They transferred the dynamite to their suitcases, pitched the empty boxes out of the train, and disappeared. The newspapers noted that the affair has created considerable consternation in the Badlands. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Get caught up.
We are learning new information this morning about the lengthy...
Take a step back.
All right, what's really going on here?
And prepare for what's ahead.
Are you expecting a breakthrough this week?
Stay on top of the news with Morning Edition from NPR News every weekday.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flato. Monday on Main Street, we'll visit with the mayor of Wahpeton, that's Brett Lambrecht, and we'll also have a high-tech conversation with AI. And we'll look forward to that. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend. And of course, we'll see you again here Monday on Main Street.